We are holding over here by a very by the next halacha in the Rambam, the next paragraph. We have spoken about the concept of basic fundamentals and ikrim and the role that they play and the significance and so on. But now we're going to go to the first point, and that is the Rambam says, Leida, the Yisora Yisoros of Mura Chachmos, that we've covered last time, the foundation and the pillars. Leida is to be aware, Sheyesh Sham Motzi Rishon, that there exists a primary entity, Vuhu Mamtzikol Nimtza, and he has brought into existence everything else that exists. V'chol HaNimtzoyim Mishamayim V'aretz, and anything that is to be found from heavens to earth, Masha B'neim, anything in between, Lo Nimtzo, exist only Elo Mamitas Himatzo, from the truth of his existence. That's the first paragraph in the Rambam. I want to start zeroing in on the very first words that he used, Motzi Rishon, and we're going to try to explain the significance, because it is possibly the most significant point the Rambam's making here. We say that a person needs to understand, believe, however you describe it, in God. Now, what does that mean? If we use the word God or Hashem, the way we call him, which is Hashem is not the right name, is the right name we do not pronounce. If a Muslim uses the word Allah, if a Christian uses the word God, or let's say a Christian uses the word Jesus, is that a belief in God or not? Is it the language that counts, the right name, getting down pat, the exact words, syllables? What is it exactly? So let's describe first what we mean by God, and then we'll realize that it's not the word per se, but it's actually the meaning attached to it that is significant. Let's go to the following scene. We have a very, very devoutly religious person, is debating and discussing theology and what have you not with a secular scientific person. Okay? Not to mind you, a scientific person can be religious, but we've set them up this way. And the religious fellow challenges the scientific fellow and says, where does the whole world come from? And with great patience, the scientific fellow explains that there was a mass of matter that had been very, very concentrated, and it expanded, exploded, etc., etc. And then he says, okay, and where did that come from? He says, well, we've actually have some very fascinating theories about it. We have string theories, and we have some sort of process of going from motion to becoming matter and different things like that. And the religious fellow challenges him and says, where did that come from? And at that point, I don't know, maybe by the time they have the conversation, we'll have another stage, but the poor scientist says, well, we don't know now. And he says, aha! And the poor scientific, secular fellow is duly humbled, and he says and whispers to the religious fellow, maybe you can enlighten me and tell me the truth, where did it come from? And he replies, God. And the scientist very meekly asks him, and pray tell me, where did God come from? He says, no, you're not allowed to ask that question, it's prohibited, absolutely prohibited to ask the question. Well, that's not much of a dialogue. It really hasn't enlightened us any, except that the religious person has the privilege of being religious, and he can pull the do not ask one. So really that argument is not a very enlightening argument. We also don't know, and except that we say, and you're not allowed to know, and the poor scientist doesn't have that restriction. So let's really understand the point of that argument. That argument is a very significant argument. It is the most significant argument, but it takes us to a very, very different place. Let's say a fellow walks out of this room and looks around, and he sees the world. He has different tools to take note of the world around him. Those are his senses. He can feel certain things. He can feel the heat of the sun. He can feel the roughness of a rock and the softness of moss. He can see the colors. He can hear the birds, etc., etc. Then a scientist comes along and will say, by the way, how much light do you see? And he says, well, I see from red to blue, and the whole gamut of colors in between. And the scientist says, no, there's ultraviolet on one end, and there's infrared on the other end. And the guy says, well, I don't see it, so it can't be light, so it doesn't exist. To which the scientist will explain very patiently that, yes, the eyes can see some light waves, some forms of light. There are other organs, humans aren't endowed with them, that can sense ultraviolet and can sense infrared. Our bodies actually can sense them. We feel the heat of infrared, and the ultraviolet can affect our cells in certain ways, which means we will know that we were affected by ultraviolet rays when we have a sunburn, perhaps, or whatever. So though they exist, and the scientists will tell us, your eyes will be perfect at detecting any photons in a certain range. They're just not good for that, for anything other than that. Same thing is true with our ears. We can detect the range of sounds from point A to point Z, but anything beyond or less vibrations or more, we can't, and that's fine. The one organ that we don't easily feel that way about is the brain or the mind. We feel that anything that exists, the concept of it should be grasped by our brains, and if it's not grasped by our brains, it doesn't exist. We're not willing to accept something which our mind cannot grasp. A world where 2 and 2 = 5 is impossible to exist, and we say it quite confidently. Okay, so what is one of the primary, what is one of the axioms? It's hard to say primary axioms, because all axioms are kind of primary. One of the axioms of logic that is unshakable, and that is that everything was caused by something else. The existence to everything is caused by some other thing. That's how we feel. If we came in, we asked the scientists, where do germs come from? And he shrugs his shoulders and says, germs don't come from any place. They just are. Germs are, because it's the nature of germs to be. We would say the guy's nuts. He's been either working long hours or he's been working with substances that he should be keeping away from. It doesn't make any sense. When we walk into a room that is stark, empty, when we walk into a room that's full with furniture, an extremely appropriate question is, where did all that furniture come from? And if the guy says, no, well, that's the way it is, the room, it just has furniture, that's not an answer. I know it came, somebody bought it, somebody brought it, somebody stole it, somebody schlepped it, somebody put it in. On the other hand, if I walk into an empty room and I were to ask somebody, where is all that emptiness come from? Well, I guess if I am a very highly regarded philosopher, people would say, oh, that's a profound question. But for most of us, that question would be kind of silly. What do you mean, where does it come from? And the answer is, because one of the elementary building blocks of our brain's logical circuit is that which came from somewhere. Everything that is there was caused by something. Now, that makes a tremendous amount of sense to us. The problem is, but that's impossible. Things do exist, and yet if everything needs something to bring it into existence, then the world could not exist. If you need it, no matter how far you're going to draw the picture, and you're going to have this tiny, 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 tiny dot of phenomenal matter with everything in the world in it, but it's so tiny, that also needs a place to come from. And the first statement we can make with confidence is that our brain, our mind, in terms of really, really in a understanding in a very gut way, not saying the words and doing the math, but really being able to come to terms with it in a way that, you know, sort of settles in. We do not, our brain is not the correct, the brain is not something which is the final, which can determine the nature of the universe. Next, we do, however, we must say the following, and it's the only thing that will really make sense, is as follows. Everything in the world, it comes from something, except for entity X, whose basic property is that it exists because it exists and doesn't come from anywhere. We can't picture it. I'm not saying that it's something that I can say and really, really understand it. It's not. It is something that, just like I can't see ultraviolet, even though I can talk about it, and I can't see infrared, even though I can talk about it, but I can say the same thing. The world contains in itself an element, an entity, whose existence is innate to itself. And just like the question of where does all that nothingness in the room come from is not a valid question, the question where does that God thing come from is not valid by the same dint of definition. Everything in the world is defined as coming from somewhere, and the question where from is a good question. God is not defined like that. And this is something that has to be. This is something that secular philosophy, well, I don't know if you call Aristotle secular or not, but this is an obvious point. Now, once we've established that, that is the first definition of God. And that's what the word primary being, Shesha Matsi Rishon. A primary being means the thing that does not require anything to have brought it into existence, that I must firmly believe. I'll never be able to picture that. I'll never be able to sort of treat it with the same way in which I treat things that do have a cause and effect. But I know that it has to be like that. This definition of God, it doesn't make a difference now what name you call it. If this is what you mean when you say Allah, then fine. And if this is what you mean when a Christian says God, that's fine. If he means a fellow who was born to a lady, and that's what the Christian fellow means, then since he needed a lady to be born from, since he needed to eat and drink when he was growing up, or else he would have died long before he was crucified, then that can't define God for us. No matter what, it just doesn't fit definition. But if he does feels definition, we've got a problem. Then it's not God as we picture it. So the word is not significant. What's important is going to be that definition. Now, there are other definitions of it. Other, I mean, further definitions, more details of that. We will see that many of those details as regards defining God, his unity, his incorporeality, and so on, are corollaries of this. And they sort of, if you tease out the argument a little more, you'll end up with those. But at the end of the day, that's the fundamental belief. And if you understand it that way, and you've worked out the corollaries appropriately, about unity and incorporeality and so on, then you have the same working definition of God as we have. And then that's the first big step in understanding that. Now it says, Vehu mamtzi kol nimtza. He brought into existence everything else. Meaning, everything else does need a cause and effect, and you cannot apply the non-cause effect, and therefore the existence of everything else is contingent on God's existence and are created beings. So we're defining God in a very, very positive sense that he is that which is a primary being, and then everything else we're defining as not being primary but linked to God as creations. This concept of defining God that way is defined in different areas by different Jewish philosophers. Some of the terms they use are Mitzias Hamuchrachas. That's used quite often. Ramchal uses it and others, which means his existence has to be. In other words, we cannot assume his non-existence. It is an existence which has to be. It's an existence which exists because of himself and not because of anything outside. Similar, just a different term. The term the Rambam chooses to use here is Motzi Rishon, a primary being, and the term that Ramchal uses and others uses, and the Rambam also in some places it's translated as such, is Mitzius HaMuchrachas, which means an existence that cannot be negative. In other words, you can't say minus God existence. It's an existence that has to be, which is in a certain way saying it's not dependent on any other factor. It's the same thing, just a sort of twist, turning the argument in the other direction. The second point is humamtzi kol nimtza, and everything else, there is nothing else in the world that has that property. It's something that will become apparent, the argument for it will become apparent when we learn about God's unity, but more than that, what'll become apparent is it's also in this very, very big distinction. If our existence were of the same quality, then we would be defining ourselves as God, kind of. So everything else is created by God. Then he says he gives three elements of things that are like that. One is v'kola nimtzoy mishmayim v'aretz u'masha b'neim. Anything in heaven, in earth, and anything in between, lo nimtzo l'mamitas himatzo, exists only because of the truth of his existence. Maimonides, generally speaking, Maimonides writes extremely well. It includes two elements. He's very, very precise and crisp, and he also writes with a certain grace and a certain beauty. In this work especially, Mishneh Torah, which is 14 volumes of his sense of the entirety of Torah laid out, crisp and to the point, is the hallmark of it. There are no extra work, no extra words. Everything is every word clicks in like a brick in its place. The term, it's kind of poetic. And everything in heavens and earth and all that is between in between are only to be seen as existing, right? Only seen as being existing from the truth of his existence. What exactly is he referring to? I would like to think, I can't tell you for sure this is what he means, but I would like to think that there's meaning in each of these entities. In other words, he's listing three things: heavens, earth, and all in between. I think that he means on a very specific way to enlighten us with each and every one of these terms. Heavens. The first mistake that a person might make in terms of associating God with similar entities is angels, heavenly beings, and so on. The Rambam, as many others, felt that stars and planets were super beings. They are better, more refined than the crass world, because they're not here. They're just luminous bodies. They're just light, and the Rambam held them to be like that, but angels for sure. Now, in the sort of popular Christian understanding, angels are sort of very, very, they're like colleagues, God's colleagues, and they kind of share a lot with God. And it, I know I can't speak for Christians, it's not, I don't represent anyone, but the popular lore of it is kind of, the angels are sort of assistant gods of types, godlike. And to us, we will discuss at some point what's the point of angels, but it is something which is totally alien. Angels and heavenly bodies and anything else that exists are there only as some sort of they are there as creations of God. They are as much creations of God as we are. They do not share in this property one whit. The angels are creatures created by God, and that's it. Don't think that they also come from the same no place that God comes from. One. There was a reverse understanding, and this was sort of the Greek, what sort of, I guess, comes across from the Greek, literature, and it sort of seeps through, that there are elements in this world so crass, so earthy, that one could not possibly imagine that this is a divine creation. If God is as gaudy as we make him to be, then could he have made an Adolf Hitler? Could he have made filth and muck and everything else that's in the world? And we would say, no, these are things that are cut from God. God didn't even touch these things. He doesn't mix into these things. God is not involved in when two murderers are planning to do something and they're having a conference. God is not there and God's not present. There's a sense of God not being there because it's too earthy. The Christian, again, and I'm speaking from popular lore, I can't speak for any as a theological representative, there's this kind of thing of the devil and his minions, and you know, this is sort of the void of God and away from God and so on. God created down to the crummiest, lowest sin, the possibility of sin. Everything that exists in the world came from God, no matter how low it is. Then he adds one more, and that which is between the two. What does he mean, that which is between the two? It does, I must admit that it rhymes poetically, and you know, I'm not going to, but I think he means something a lot specific. We've eliminated one mistake of something that's God-like, our angels. One mistake of something that's absolutely non-God is the lowest, the material world, the physical world, the ugly world, the slime of the world. And we've said, yo, both of these are connected to God. They're not God, they're created creatures of God. There's one more entity in the world that gives God a serious run for his money. And let's explain what that would be. We assume, and again, we'll talk about this sometime later, we'll take it as an assumption that free will does not exist anywhere in the world, except for man. In other words, everything is pre-programmed. Tigers are pre-programmed to eat animals. Lambs are pre-programmed to, you know, kind of sit and bleat, not do anything, not harm anybody. Angels are pre-programmed, and so on. So all of those entities show themselves to be dependent on a programmer. In other words, it's very clear that we can look at an elephant as being the result of something. Of creation, because his whole entity is dependent. It's been pre-programmed, and elephants do what elephants do, and that's that. Human beings can decide to be Moshe Rabbeinu or Adolf Hitler. They make that decision, certainly, as far as we can tell. And they've got nothing dictating to them. Things can be harder, things can be easier. But we in our belief of free will, we posit that man, at the end of the day, it's up to him. And any decision is his own. God's not to blame, his parents not to blame, society's not to blame. God is not to be praised, society's not to be praised, his teacher's not to be praised. He, at the end of the day, input helped him or hindered, but it's him. So the entity in the world that is between the two most aptly describes man, because man is between the two worlds, the higher and the lower. And that in between means free agent. He can swing either way. That's probably the most godlike quality in this sense, that it is not. If A comes from B, then A is dependent. A cannot contain something that wasn't there in B. A is limited by B. And if a man is not limited in any way that we can tell, that means that man is actually godlike in some way. And so he says, well, that also is not. Lo nimotzu ela maimitas himotzu. So everything within the world comes as a result of God's existence. So God exists because he exists, period. We exist because God existed and endowed us with existence. Once he endows with existence, the laws of physics take over, free will takes over, a lot of other things take over. But that's from point one onwards. And now the Rambam fleshes it out with two sort of corollaries, just to give us some more of a picture. Two, v'miyala ladas, if one could entertain the idea, shehu einay motzui, that God does not exist, ein dava acha yochli motzos, nothing else could exist. In other words, nothing else has made itself in any way. This is true on a very, very fundamental theological level. It's also true on a more human level, I would say, in the elements of theology dealing between man's relationship to God. We have a lot of let's call them rabbis, people who publicly like to display their rabbinics. And they're always taunting God, challenging him to all sorts of verbal and mental duels. How can you do this? And where's justice? And, you know, I challenge you to prove X, to why you did this to me, to the Jewish people, to the Holocaust, etc., etc., etc. That would be fine if God owed us for something because we put in something of our own. Imagine that if I work for somebody, so I work for him, he pays me. If he, if I don't like the pay that he's giving or the conditions for severance, whatever, I can say, I've done this for you. And where is your reciprocity? That's a fair point. Or, you know, we've made it a contract. I will do X, Y, and Z, you will do A, B, and C. I've supplied this, why haven't you supplied this? Good point. But let's say somebody gives me alms, he gives me charity every week for no reason. He doesn't know me for any reason, he's a kind man, he gives me, and then he skips a week. I can't come with an argument. I mean, I can beg, I can plead, I can this, that, the other thing, but there's no room for arguing. You know, and I can't say, how come the other guy gave money? We get very annoyed when someone says, how can you give the other guy money? Well, what's it your business? It's one thing if you're paying an employee X and this employee something else, you can say, you're cheating me because you see that that's the right amount, you owe me something, and the question is just what you owe me. If I'm your accountant, you owe me something. The question is, what's fair wage? And there might be two opinions of that. But if I give you charity, and not because you did anything for me, not because I owe you favors, not because of anything, just because I decided to give you charity, there's no room for argument or debate. God is the one who gave us existence. So what does he owe us? If he gave us one day of life, does he owe us a second day of life? If he gave us children, does he owe us grandchildren? If he, what does he owe us? What kind of argument? Where's the debate? Now, parenthetically, it is, you do find in the Bible, you find in two or three places where the prophets debated God on it. The if you look carefully at it and you read it carefully, they're not debates, they are inquiries. In other words, the sort of framework for the discussion is, God, you have told us that you want us to understand the fairness of your ways. You have declared and proclaimed that your ways will be perceived as fair to us. That's mishpat, that's tzedek. That we will be able, with the human minds, be able to see and understand the fairness of it all. We're having difficulties with case X, case Y, Z. Please, God, enlighten us. Or it's a personally very, very stressful for me to have to live through something that I don't understand. So good, that makes a lot of sense. That is fine. But when it becomes an argument for justice, that doesn't make any sense. If God were not to exist, nothing else exists. Our existence is not innate to us, and we only exist. We exist by the grace of God. It's not as if we exist, but He gave us money. He didn't give us money. He gave us self, and He owes nothing, and we don't have any self justification for existence, and therefore we are going to. There are no arguments. The flip side is as follows. He says paragraph 3 in the Rambam. V'myal al adas she'ein kol emtsoim levada mitzuyim, and were we to entertain the possibility, if one could entertain the possibility, that nothing would exist besides God, hu levado yeh matzuy, he will remain in existence, v'lo yibatel hu lebitulam, his own existence will not at all be negated by their a negation. Shekola nimtsoim suichem lo, because everything in the world that exists needs him for their existence. Vehu baruch hu, whereas God himself, einat tzarich lahem, lo le'echad mehem, does not need the world in its entirety, nor in any part of it. Now, this corollary, or sort of, this is a converse of what we said before, is meant, I mean, it's true, as it stands, but it also has a very important implication. It implies the following. Whatever we can do in the world, we do not add anything to God, we do not detract from God. If we sin, we're not actually doing something hurtful to God in a real way. And if we do good deeds, mitzvahs, we're not adding anything to God. Now, this is something which is a little bit difficult for the following reason, difficult to understand. On one level, we do actually, we speak about finding favor in God's eyes and doing what's right in His eyes and God being happy with us and satisfied with us and God being hurt by us and so on. Those words and those terms, those ideas do exist. Let's explain in what context they exist. Again, we're going to use different illustrations, but illustrations are just illustrations. It's when you want to apply it. Ultimately, we have a problem of being able to understand it, but it still helps us a little bit to understand it. Imagine you have a teacher in a classroom. I remember when I was in fourth grade, we had a teacher who was a very, very tough and rough teacher, and she was really, really difficult. We used to call her Mrs. X because she was such a terror. And, you know, the boys really, really were terrified of her. One day on some class trip, she came along. She took class on trip, and she brought along a son of hers, and we were shocked that she actually can have a husband and children. I don't know, we thought of her as some sort of witch, I guess, I don't know what our imaginations were. but that somebody actually could have a very loving relationship with her and children and so on was beyond our imagination. That's because we mistook, we didn't understand this person has two roles. There is a big circle of a person, real person with a normal life, and within that circle is a smaller circle called teacher mode, in which she made a decision, she has to be very tough and very strict and no nonsense. God has created an interface with us, and that interface has a very human face to it. We think of mitzvahs as doing good in God's eyes, and God reflects it by showing us favors, showing us pleasantness of life, and vice versa. But that's not inherent to God. It's not as if God, on a day that I didn't do a mitzvah, God has a hard time sleeping that night. Those things don't work. God is God, and we haven't affected him. And the pasuk says, if you've sinned, what have you done to me? And if you've done well, what have you given me? If we were to disappear, God would not be less than he is. And therefore, we know that God rewards for good, or not God punishes. We know that there's an interaction where God justifiably calls himself, he is pleased, we find favor in his eyes. It is correct, but at the level of the interface, not at the level of essence. So we'll just sum up, and that'll be it. So the Rambam here has defined, first of all, what God is, a primary being, which the most significant piece of that is existence is innate to itself, and the question where from has no meaning. It just doesn't, because this is a type of existence, that the existence is inherent to it. Everything else is not that way. There is nothing else that could possibly be that way, and everything else exists because of God as creator. This includes the highest elements of creation. This includes the lowest and crudest elements of creation. And it includes man, who uniquely has a very, very godlike a sense to himself. And everything, all of that comes from God. He also says, if were we able to project that God doesn't exist, nothing else exists, we've shown how that might be, how that affects us in our relationship and our the rights to demand certain things from God and so on, and vice versa. If we were to entertain the idea that nothing exists, God wouldn't become one whit smaller. And if he doesn't become one whit smaller, that means we're not giving him anything or denying him anything when we do mitzvahs or averos, and therefore we can't come along feeling we've given God something or not. It is the goodwill of God to reward us and to punish us. Fine. But there is no inherent change, so to speak, in what we call God. Okay, we'll hold it here.